Welcome to What's My Thesis. I'm Javier Proenza, and today my guest is Christina Victor, returning guest. We talked about flags last time. Very, very informative. We have an idea. We're both grieving, so we're probably going to talk a little bit about grief. But can we start with Miami? Because I want.
Of course, I know you want to go there. You can't help it.
Well, I want to say that when your friend passed away, you posted a picture, and I was like. I thought it was my sister had posted a picture because you look as a young woman exactly like my little sisters. Yeah. And I sent them to them and they were like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
So like, it's just so funny. It was so reassuring to like, be like, oh, I am Cuban, you know,
but it was tender because it's like, I think that happened and I was open about it and shared it. And you know, a lot of people send their condolences, but I felt like you were like, you look like us.
Yeah.
And it's like, I feel like, you know, the few times that we've spoken, we kind of really connect on growing up in Miami because it was such a unique experience. Once you start talking to other people and where they grew up and like the stuff that just culturally, how dense it was, but, it connected with me that you were like, you look.
Yeah, yeah.
Like sister and I, and I was like, that's exactly what it felt like. He was my brother.
No, but my sister was like, holy shit.
I know you sent me the screenshot and I was like, yeah, he's not lying.
She was like, oh my God.
Yeah.
Pero, okay, háblame de ser cubano. No, I'm
no,
kidding.
No, come on, hold on. You already tried this the first time. Let's like mix it up.
Well,
we're more than just Cuban, Javier.
I know, but I went to Miami recently and I was like, it was.
Sacúdete, sacúdete, dale, dale, dale.
It was just so refreshing. Like where Latinos are not like third class citizens over here, it's like,
yeah,
it's like you know, like over there it's like, fuck you, I'm great.
Yeah. That is the general attitude. Yeah, also get the fuck out of my way, I gotta go somewhere.
Yeah. And like and what is interesting over there is that they don't talk about gringos, they talk about americanos,
you know, very seldom do you hear the word gringo.
That's not a término de nosotros.
Or they don't say la gente blanca or no, blancos. No. They say americanos.
It's like it's an ethnic distinction between us and them.
I know,
but yeah, no, I went back. I hadn't been back in like to talk about grief, I hadn't been back in like 10-15 years.
Technically, really?
Yeah. No, I had not been back. It's so crazy different. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I wanted to update you on is that I tried dating on Hinge over there, and it was very quickly easy to notice that I immediately noticed it is the per capita highest number of OnlyFans models there are in the country.
Are you serious?
In Miami. Yeah. Y cuando vas a la playa, when you go to the beach, you see like...
I love going to the beach though.
I know.
I love it.
I know. I didn't stop doing it.
The best entertainment in the world. So I have the whole crew of like friends that, you know, were connected to this one friend that passed away. A lot of them live in Miami or a couple of them do. Mm-hmm. And so they share about their dating experiences there. And it's just like, they'll just send us like messages and screenshots of like what girls say. And I'm just like... Like straight up like, hey, do you want to help me buy a car?
Yeah.
Venmo me right now. And I'm like, que de caro. That's what dating is like down there. I'm like, God damn.
It's pretty crazy. And there's like, I've never seen more, like I've never felt more like the people that were showing up in my feed were using it to get me onto their Instagram and then to get me onto their OnlyFans. And then you would see things like, I like a generous man, you know, really interesting.
It's like
things.
In Craigslist when cozy meant small.
Yeah. And the other thing that was crazy is like, there's so many New Yorkers there and like the road rage there has gotten crazy, dude. Like people freak out over nothing. I'm like, you guys should drive in LA.
No, I think the road rage is exactly what it was. It's just there's more people to have it and it's very contagious, as we know, but the amount of New Yorkers has significantly changed the culture
and the
economy of Miami. Yeah. And so I think during COVID there was like this massive influx of people from up north they are the people filling those condos. They are the people
the ones who made it super expensive to live there. Like,
I mean, it started a while ago and I know the art world would be like, oh my God, I can't just say that. That's terrible. It's Basel. Basel had a lot to do with shifting that. And I feel like the economy, that's where it really started. But I think COVID really
really tip amplified.
The scale yeah. when it came to that. And people are just like hanging on bloody knuckles, you know, to yeah. their homes and being there. And it's interesting to hear the same conversations around gentrification and like sort of displacement and development that you hear out here and go back there, because that's not something anyone ever really talked about when we yeah. were out
well,
there.
Well, Fred Snitzer can't afford to be in Wynwood anymore. Neither can Emerson Dorsch. I don't feel bad for them. I'm just saying that they
Dorsch is cool.
No, I don't feel bad for anybody. I'm just saying that the gentrification cycle of putting
now,
an
now
art
it's
gallery.
Just like scaling up, yeah, up so, the classes. Yeah. yeah.
So you put an art, you put the art galleries in the bad neighborhood, and then it brings culture in there.
Bad.
And, well, I mean, it wasn't safe for ladies to walk. I remember the woman. Yeah. Well, I remember when I was working at Snitzer, there was a woman.
I didn't know you worked at Snitzer.
It was very brief, but yeah I did.
And, I worked at the Rubels.
Oh, really? How was that?
That's another day.
No, we don't talk bad about people.
I'm grateful for the experience. Yeah, I have thoughts. But yeah, yeah. Not prepared to talk about them today.
No. I went back and it was shocking to see how small the art scene is there. You know, even
really?
after all this time.
Do you have friends that you hang out with as far as artists there?
Yeah. Jessica Gispert. And,
oh, okay.
Yeah. So
you feel like it's gotten smaller?
No, I don't think it's gotten small. I just think it's not big. You know, like I think that the differences between here and there is like you have like the bigger galleries, you have the Hauser and Wirth. So there's more of
But also it's a seasonal art scene there. It's very seasonal. I feel like a lot of locals would disagree with that because I know that there's a lot going on throughout the year. But
they're also in denial.
Outside of Basel, there is stuff going on. It's just like there isn't this influx of eyes way that it's just so polarizing. It's so Miami's just like all about like selling itself to tourism and whatever mm-hmm. that tourism is. And I think in the last like decade, Art Basel is definitely like a major moneymaker for the city when it comes to tourism.
I think there's also a crazy turn happening over there because of like I don't think people can afford to do Airbnbs as much as they used to. Like they can't travel the same way that they could maybe during COVID and whatnot. And I think that is driving up home prices like in a crazy amount because there are all these places like I think only 30% in Broward. I think this is the data for Broward, but I think like 30% of them get rented out. Like, you know, 30% of the year. Completely vacant.
It's not profitable anymore, but.
But I think that there's a tax write-off opportunity there. So you rent it like maybe once or twice, and then you have a nice home that you can write the losses off.
A ton of people don't get homes.
exactly. But Little Haiti was like where, you know, like I think Dimensions Variable is there. And
I like them a lot. Their exhibitions. Cool. They've been at it for a long time. I respect their space a lot.
They've pretty much been at it since I left, like 15 years.
The Bakehouse too. There's a lot of good artists there. People I've known for a really long time and they've sustained studios there. Many years.
I know I kind of trashed the size of the scene, but I do want to go and document some of it. One of the things that really pissed me off is I think Jessica shared a thing where it was where like somebody was saying, I forget who it was in relation to Art Miami, like that retrospective that they did during Basel.
Oh yeah, I had a couple friends in that, sure.
Yeah, and it was like Locust Projects and all of that. Mm-hmm. And
TM Sisters.
Yeah, the TM Sisters, they're still around, man. Do they still use the lightning as a
I don't think they've been
motif?
Doing as much collaborative stuff, but independently they're doing their own thing.
Okay.
But I love them very much and I've known them since we were like art babies and I respect them a lot. So I was really glad that they were getting eyes on like the work because they have been a substantial part of the scene for a really long time.
Well, that was what really irritated me. All that, like somebody was saying on a reel that was like, they were like, all these people are coming from New York and they were like, was there any art like happening before we got here? And I was like, you assholes.
What the fuck?
Jen Stark, Burt Rodriguez, house. The house, all of these things that are like
all those New World School of the Arts.
Yeah, yeah. Leo,
like there was so much going on.
Yeah,
it just like it was going
the Gizmo
on
girls.
underground, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And that's what I mean. Like, I don't think it's a small scene, but I don't think, or I mean, I think it's an active scene and it's a community, but I don't think, like, compared to LA, there aren't, like, the sheer number of galleries. It's like comparing LA to New York, you know, it's not fair.
Yeah.
And LA's tiny compared to New York.
Yeah. You know? You can't really do it. And it's just different. It's a different makeup,
yeah.
you know, and different things that influence and things outside of the art world that really influence what happens there. But it's a tough place to stay and be an artist. It really is. Yeah. I couldn't hack it. I left.
Yeah.
So I really respect people who stayed there or who've moved there and really, like my friend Maria Barbas, like there's people who've moved there and really like integrated into the community and tried their best to just keep it alive and keep it inclusive.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a constant struggle. Like, I think it's tough to be an artist down there, but if you stay there, it's because you love being there and you love it. And that's hard to love Miami all the way through the year, every year.
It's a crazy place.
I encourage you to go back more often.
No, I'm going
to
go in April.
Because I mean, yeah, it's just, it's you're a totally, love-hate thing, you know?
I'm kind of hoping that some rich Cuban guy is going to be like, oh, I took Juanito. Let me give him money.
Okay. There's Hinge for that. There's apps for that.
Oh, no. I'm not looking to be.
What do you want? How bad do you want it?
I don't want to be no Johnny Versace murderer. What's it with Andrew Cunanan?
Oh, my God. I remember that.
But there is a whole scene. I mean, you could sustain yourself like that for sure in Miami.
For sure. That would be there's an economy in that.
Yeah, for sure. But yeah, dude, I mean, it was mind blowing to be back. I left with a bit of a chip on my shoulder with the art world there. Cause it was just,
time of year did you go?
I went for Basel.
Oh,
but I didn't go to Basel, but I went during Basel, that era. And then I went and I just did like the local things. Like I said, I went Art Miami and that kind of thing. Cause I was like nostalgic for that. Like
that's cool that you got to see that.
Yeah. They had a retrospective of Gizmo stuff and which is like Crystal Pearl and Jessica Gispert. They're old. Yeah. Like that's old school. Like if you've heard those this stuff, like you were there.
But it's like quirky stuff like that was going on, I think, when Miami started to get noticed as an art scene, and I think that's what the appeal was. It was like quirky and kind of magical and abstract and. Mm-hmm. Just fascinating. It's stuff you didn't see anywhere else.
Yeah. But I definitely recommend Miami as an art scene. I just think that it is like, I just think that what ends up happening is because there are no huge Gagosian, or maybe there's a Gagosian, but there's not a David Zwirner. There's not, you know, on the same level that there is.
But does that have to exist in order for an art scene to be legitimized or interesting?
It doesn't, but
I don't think so.
But it makes it bigger. You know, and it makes it like, cause the Rubels and whatnot are great, but a lot of the work, you know, sometimes they'll do shows of like contemporary work and stuff, but a lot of the stuff in the collection is old, you know, as opposed to being able to see like, you know, like you can go to Hauser & Wirth and you can see some old work, like that Candor show that I forget who it was, but like.
So you're saying there needs to be more large, legitimate, like kind of. Polished spaces.
I'm not saying there needs to be. I don't want to do anything to change Miami.
No, yeah. I know, but that to me just sounds like a lack of representation. You know what I mean? Like there's a lack of representation of contemporary art that's happening there in like larger spaces.
It's I mean, it's a peninsula, but it's a very long one, which makes it an island, right? Mm. So I think that there's like, I think a lot of the people there are very East Coast minded, right? Mm. Like, so I just think it's hard to not be in the shadow of a place like New York, you know, when you're there, or even a Philadelphia, you know, like if you, it, I mean, I see the big artists are showing at Perez and all of that, like, right. Like the people that are represented by Zwirner and whatnot, they do show down there and they do show at the Perez and the Rubels and the Margulies and all of that. But the institutional manpower, I don't think is really quite there of like having, you know, like, you know, I mean, there's just so much more that you can see. Not that I ever engage with that, but I don't think it legitimizes the scene. It just means that there are higher levels, like the ceiling, you know, like you leave Miami because at a certain point you're like, well, I know everybody in the art scene, you know, and the opportunities aren't necessarily coming, not because it's a click or anything, but just because they're just not interested in what I'm doing or whatever.
And yeah, that's what I felt. I was also really young when I left. I just, the things I was curious about, I wasn't seeing representation in the like of what I wanted my direction as an artist to be. And I was like, I have to get out. I didn't see interdisciplinary work going on a lot. And I just was like, I think I want to do a lot of things. And this place is telling me I have to do one thing and I have to show in galleries and sell. And that was a priority. And I was like, I don't fucking know anything. I'm a kid. I don't know anything. Yeah, yeah, I don't have anything to say. I don't know who I am. And there was this like hard pressure to like jump into what's going on with Basel. And I was like, I don't think I'm ready for that. And the high school system is really strong. The arts high school system.
Did you go to New World?
I went to New World, but the college program. Okay. So I went to Miami-Dade. It's a community college system that like kind of helps integrate you. And then you get credits through other institutions. But it was like at the beginning of Basel. And it felt like they were starting to condition us to just like strive for the galleries right now, make stuff to show and like find the one thing and like stick to that. And I was like, that's the opposite of what I want to do. So I left. I am glad I left, but I still am really grateful for the New World experience. Cause God, that shit made me like critique without apologies. And everywhere else I went, I was kind of a menace.
Well, and the interesting thing about New World is that you had somebody that was a gallerist that taught at the school, right? Like, I think one of the biggest ambition.
Yeah, and there was like really like elder contemporary artists that were like really well respected, Carol Brown. There's a lot of people that were teaching. There wasn't a lot to access, but the classes we did have were like really rich and intensive. Like they cared to like really push the scene forward with this like young crop of students that were coming in. And I think it really had an effect on all of us.
Yeah. But I like for
Karen Refus, she was another one that was a teacher of mine. I'm like so glad I had her.
I felt like what I went to FIU, which was a not as prestigious a program. And I felt like I was in competition with my teachers for showing opportunities, which was weird. Like one time I went and I talked to a professor about signing up for like applying for the Cintas Fellowship. See, it's a fellowship for Cuban artists and whatnot. And my teacher was like, I'm applying for that. Like that's not for like new young artists. And I'm like, okay, I get it, but you could have also guided me through the process of doing it to, you know, like, I'm obviously not going to get it, but I would
have learned. It's a learning process. Yeah. Also, getting rejected is a good thing, you know, like learning how to manage that. And sometimes rejection leads you to other opportunities. So that's weird that, But I think, and FIU was so far west and it's geographically, like, there wasn't a whole lot going on out in Kendall.
No, there isn't. And, I mean, there's also the North Campus, but most of the art program is on the, I'm so relieved to talk to somebody that wasn't tortured by the same teachers.
Aww.
But I do think that, like, for example, in that it, like, I think my understanding, at least from the people that I worked with at Snitzer, was that a lot of the people in New World, their ambition was to get into his gallery, you know, which changes the whole dynamic into a more market-based kind of thing. And I had a new friend of mine. I didn't know him in Miami, but my friend introduced me to him, Daniel Young. He like went to New World at the high school and then left to Cooper. And then after he was done with Cooper Union, he didn't know what to do with himself because he was like not like he was still very young and it's like overwhelming. So he had a really good education and then he was just
kind of lost with what to do with it.
And he's back now, but it was like...
But that's an art school problem in general. Sure. And as someone who's worked in different arts-focused higher ed institutions, both doing admissions and teaching, there's a gap there that a lot of schools don't address, and there's a lack of mentorship because we're all kind of flying blind. And I have to admit that leaving Miami when I did, I rejected the whole like I don't want to fold into the market part of it. Was working for like collectors and seeing the other side of things and who collected what and why and how that worked. And I was really uncomfortable with all that dynamic. And I was like, I'm not ready for this. I don't want to manage this. I also am weird about money. And I was like, I feel like I want to keep this money idea and like the art making really separate, which is very pure of me. But also now it's like as an adult, I don't really show in formal galleries. I tend to show at nonprofits and artist run spaces, and that's beautiful. And I'm always so grateful for it. But it also means I don't sell.
Yeah.
And so there's still like this sort of managing of like how you want to navigate the art world and how can you be sustainable, that I think most art teaching spaces, whether they're higher ed or anything, just aren't quite all on the same page. There's no formula for how to do it.
And the schools don't necessarily teach it. The New World seems to be the one that most tries to get you in that mindset of any school that I've heard of.
Tangent.
deep. No, no.
Miami art scene.
Miami art scene is really interesting to me. I am going to dive into it. I ran into, do you know Antonia Wright?
Mm-mm.
Okay. I knew her before either of us had any inkling of being artists. And then I ran into her at Dimensions Variable and we reminisced. I'm not going to share the stories of the crazy fun times that we had as kids, but like, I just knew her through other people. And so like, we just lost touch. And then years later, I'm like, holy shit, you're here, you know? And it's really funny. Like I both like now how small, like Miami is like a small town.
It is. It really is.
It really is. Mm-hmm. And over here, I can tell.
It's a noisy small town. It's very noisy.
It's a noisy small town with subgenres, mm-hmm. right? So like, so there's a lot of people in the art world, but everybody kind of knows each other. Over here, I keep meeting people that don't know anybody that knows me. So I think by virtue of those bigger galleries being here, it attracts more people that are into those cultural experiences, right? And then the other thing is, I think, like, you know, we mentioned Dimensions Variable and places like that, but, and Locust Projects and all of those, and the Hernan Boss and all those artists run places, Boss Fisher.
I was like, Hernan Boss? I was like, you mean Boss? Yeah.
Yeah, Boss Fisher Invitational. All of those places that were like super important to us growing up. I mean, I they're still in my mind, mm-hmm. right? And I still have mad
respect.
But it's
also those places were special because they were like led by artists. You know what I mean? Yeah,
but there's more of that here, I think. Mm-hmm. There's more artists that are doing that for themselves. So there are more, like the amount of artist run spaces, the sheer number of them, despite how expensive it is out here, there's more people putting resources into those opportunities simply by virtue of that. And I can't imagine New York has that in the same, because I don't know. I've talked to a few New York artists. I don't actually know in the New York scene that well at all. I'm just trying to, you know,
I lived there twice and I still feel like I don't know it.
But if you look at the numbers, it's almost four times the number of galleries.
Yeah.
And if you look at David Zwirner, they have like 30 New York. Now it's not 30, but they have like a bunch of New York ones, and they'll have like one LA one, one Hong Kong one, you know, and then one in some random place that makes them niche, you know, like Zurich or something like that. Hmm. But like the main five are New York, Hong Kong, Paris, LA, and then another one that I can't remember right now. That's the problem with lists. You always miss the last one. But anyway, let's talk about grief. It's an art podcast, so I just kind of wanted to.
I think it's great. I mean, it's all relevant.
And I know that you know these places too, because this was our like aspirational community. And it was accessible.
How we got experience the art, in like a professional sense, like mm-hmm. when we were going to school, or when I was going to school, I was doing internship at these spaces, or. It's how we kind of like got a sense of how things could work, because a lot of them were kind of New York sort of framework kind of spaces. Like the Rubels came from New York, you know, mm-hmm. De La Cruz, not so much, but you know, the like private collections then becoming museums, I think was an interesting phenomenon there.
But LA, how many, like the Cheech collection, that's the only
so
one
that
I can
opened
think.
Up recently, right? Or at least after I left LA. So I'm really curious to check it out.
But yeah, there aren't as many, like, I don't know what it is about Miami that there are like independently wealthy art aficionados, you know, like
snowbirds.
Yeah. Yeah.
They gotta do something with their, you know, the time.
They collect. Yeah. And it must be amazing to just have that level of money where you can just have a collection and you're like, here, peasants, enjoy.
I mean, it was real good education for me. It's like, I got to handle the last, you know, Keith Haring ink drawings and help restore them.
Yeah.
And every time I see those, I'm like, I feel like I'm looking at my youth. You know what I mean?
No,
and we did get access to really unique work because of those collectors coming to Miami. Like I can't believe I got to see all that contemporary art like firsthand and handled it, because of the internships and opportunities I had. But that the politics and the, like the learning experience wasn't complicated. Oh my God.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very much so.
No, yeah. And it's strange how visible collectors are there as opposed to over here.
They talk to people.
And whereas over here, I don't know who the main collectors are out here.
Yeah.
But it's an interesting phenomenon to have that instead of major galleries, you know, like they're filling in that void, which is great because as museums tend to be more educational anyway. And I got to see Diana Arbus. I got to see stuff that like I would not have had access to if there weren't collectors like collections like that.
Did you see the Margulies?
Yeah. Margulies has a great photography collection, man.
I remember those were like the field trips we had.
Fuck, we gotta go. We gotta coordinate a trip. Bring Oye Padron. what's his name?
Eduardo.
You need to bring Eduardo. We're gonna do.
I drag him to all the museums and shows. Poor guy.
Is he an art guy?
He's not, but now he has to be. He's a music guy. He's a metalhead, and
he's a metalhead. Mm-hmm. Miami metalheads. Yeah. Oh, that brings me back. Fucking going to Alapata and shit. Which is like
warehouses and Kendall.
Oh my god, dude. Yeah. Anyway, nostalgia.
It's hard for us to not reminisce. I mean, we weren't in each other's lives, but it's like I think there's a common language to like being in Miami and growing up there.
Of course, man. Especially because we both have the art thing. If you were a club kid and I was an artist, like
I was also a club kid.
But I mean, like were you like a house DJ aficionado, or were you into like more the drum and bass rave scene?
I like to visit these different worlds.
Did you ever go to Leprechaun Liberation at Grand Prix?
No, but I did go to Space.
Okay. Space is still around, dude. That's crazy.
I lived in South Beach. Like I was 18 when I moved out, and I got an apartment with one of my best friends, and we lived in South Beach, and we lived that life. And it was just like, oh my God. I mean, you're 18 and, you know, experimenting with drugs and like going to these like great gay clubs and that don't exist anymore. And it's just like, you feel like a queen down there. It was great. It was wonderful.
Does the Abbey still exist? The dive bar?
Oh, I think it recently closed. Ugh. I think it recently announced it was going to close, but that place was awesome.
It was the best, especially because it was like the antithesis of all the aesthetic of everything else.
It was like where you can go watch soccer and drink a beer.
Yeah. Well, anyway, let's now I feel like we're avoiding grief as a topic, but
is what happens.
I just lost. I mean, I guess this is part of the grieving process, reminiscing in the childhood stuff. You know? But I lost my dad last year, and you lost a very close friend that you grew up with. There is something about those Miami friendships, especially in the 90s when you when there was no phones and nothing to do.
Yeah.
And you would just be in each other's company.
Yeah. And you were like a wild kid and parents were like, I don't know, go be busy. I got shit to do.
Yeah.
You just become each other's family.
My mom, there was a period where my mom would frantically call everybody that I knew because she didn't know where I was.
Where you were? Javier ahí?
Yeah. And then finally, when I started telling them that I was where I was and where I was going, they would let me stay out until 5 a.m.
Oh my God. It was the same thing with my mom. And she was just like, just tell me where you're going and what you're doing. Yeah. And I was like, I'm going to Maria Angela's house and we're going to the planetarium.
Yeah.
What we did at the planetarium.
Well, no, the planetarium is not necessarily the least drug friendly place that exists. I mean, I got high there the first time.
That's right. Did LSD several times. We're not encouraging these things, but it is part of our story and our narrative.
Yeah, we cleaned
fentanyl
ourselves.
Was not around.
Jesus Christ, no.
We knew where our drugs were coming from.
And it was Miami. I'm sure that in Miami, I'm not encouraging people to test this.
No, please don't.
But I'm sure in Miami, you don't get it as cut as you would elsewhere, you know? Like, you could still find the chunky cocaine. Like when I was growing up, where you had to like sift it through a colander, you know, like that's how you know that it's not cut with anything instead of just getting a thing of powder. You learn things in Miami. I don't encourage people to learn the same thing.
Street smarts.
Well, do you have any younger siblings?
I have three half brothers. They're much younger. My dad remarried and his wife is much younger. And so they kind of like, he had like a second go of like family life. I adore them. I mean, they call me the Cuban sister and
they're not Cuban.
They're Cuban on my dad's Cuban, but, I think they lean more to their, mom who's Israeli.
Israeli. Okay.
So they're Jewish. They grew up Jewish. But they're wonderful.
But the question was going to be more about like, were they as into drugs?
No.
We hit a generation.
Well, they grew up in Broward, and I think my parents did a good job of taking them very far away from the that vibe. My stepmom and my dad, like, they really just tried to give them a really kind of pure and sheltered world, and they grew up like, you know, going to the same.
As opposed to our parents that were like, go rage. No, I mean, I really do think that we ended up catching the tail end because we're about the same age. We caught the tail end because all of my friends were all degenerates and their siblings were like, learn from our mistakes.
Man, growing up in Miami in the 80s and 90s was no joke.
No,
like you had to develop street smarts. You had to be able to know like stranger danger, like real quick. And you had to like know how to fight. You had to know how to like anticipate bad situations. There was a lot of crime. Mm-hmm. And that was like just the norm for us. Like sometimes when I tell stories about growing up in Miami, things that happen, my friends are looking at me like, what? That was part of your childhood? And I'm like, yeah, I don't know. That's just like, but it was a really volatile kind of intense place. There was a lot of like, drug trafficking happening and a huge, there was always an influx of like communities, like immigrant communities trying to like survive. And so it creates this sort of, quítate tú pa ponerme yo, environment. But I think, I'm grateful though. I grew up in that environment.
I have, like I said, I'm nostalgic for it, but it is a crazy thing. I remember
it's
when
it's unique. Like it's not a common experience to grow up experiencing the things that we experience, or that freedom to just like,
Fuck off.
Yeah.
You said off. I said up.
Fuck but... off and fuck up. You'll be fine. Dale.
Sacúdete.
Yeah, let's go.
Just brush it
Don't
off.
Don't be stupid.
Yeah. No, it's a funny thing to be from there. And I, we really don't know each other.
We
remember every now and then that mm-hmm. but te tengo mucho cariño porque
I know
that like,
same.
I know I'm like, oh, she's like, she looks like my sister. But yeah, no, it's a very funny thing. I remember when I left Miami for the first time and started telling people that like, and was surprised that I was the only one that did roofies recreationally when I was 15. Oh, and like, people were like, what?
Everybody had a vice that they did pretty regularly. There was readily available, you know, it's a party culture. It was a very intense party culture. You learn to party and do drugs very young.
And people come there for that, you know, mm-hmm. and people would like, I remember like people would come from other places outside of Miami and live there, work at a restaurant, sleep 3 hours a night, and then just party the rest of the time. When I went there, I was like, at around 2 a.m., I was at Bougainvillea's in South Miami. And I was like, hey, are you guys closing? Do I need to, like, I was like getting my last call and they were like, oh no, we close at 4. And I was like, what?
Yeah. Everything would close at 5.
Yeah. Yeah. And then the after
you'd come
party
out and
would
see
start.
The sun. Yeah. Or go swim in the ocean naked sober up.
Did you ever go to Lugo Point?
I don't think so. No.
Oh, okay. It was like a secret, like little peninsula that you could, it was a gated community you could get to.
Oh, I think I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then you would see the horizon, the bend of the horizon. Cause you had so much of it, of ocean in front of you. And then we would see dolphins there after like a rave and stuff.
I would often go swimming to the beach. That's how I would end a night regularly. I was a Pop Life girl. I worked the door.
Oh, you worked at Pop Life?
I worked the door of Pop Life for like,
which,
over
where, in the
a year.
Design district?
Both, the Piccadilly Garden. And then when they moved to IO.
Yeah. Okay.
So I worked with them for a little while.
This is inside baseball as shit. But
Miami people are going to know what we're talking about.
But that was like where the art scene hung out.
We're still
too.
Avoiding grief though.
I know. We can, whenever you want to dive in, I'm very sad that my dad died.
Yeah.
No, I mean, grief is an interesting thing. And I do think that grief is somewhat tied to nostalgia too. So it's not like,
absolutely.
Yeah. But all right. Tell me a little bit about your friend. Let's memorialize him a little bit. Okay. Is that okay?
It is. I mean, I think I'm getting used to the fact that I think I'm doing this in different ways over and over. Mm. I didn't anticipate it. And I think there's this sort of like, I felt it's just so overwhelming to lose someone that's our age mm-hmm. in such a tragic kind of like sudden way. And so the idea of it just being like, oh, you go to a memorial and then you say, okay, that's it.
Yeah.
And that just doesn't sit right with me. And he was just like incredibly impactful to my life, and not just me, like our circle of friends. Mm-hmm. And so I think I'm still working through it in different ways, and I'm learning what grief is like for other people, this kind of grief. So he was wonderful, and he was part of my childhood friends. I grew up with a lot of guys in my life, and they were the best part of my adolescence. And well, so he was like the nucleus of it, you know?
Yeah, yeah. La Cubanita were very much interested in very, very specific, like Lourdes girls.
I was so far from a fucking Lourdes girl.
The private school girls and all of that. Yeah.
I have no idea what that's like to wear those crisp shirts and the pearls and shit. And the, what was it? The moccasins they would wear. Anyway, yeah, yeah. And that really wasn't my experience. I was a grungy.
Were you South Miami?
Angsty teenager. You Coral Park.
Coral Park. Okay.
Ruben Dario, Coral Park. Yeah, I was not that.
So wait, you were in Coral Park is like, is that near Coral Reef? No.
It's in 87th and like Flagler or Coral Way.
Near, oh, okay. So you're Flagler, north.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
But I went to high school with the same people I went to middle school with that I went to elementary school with. And so there was this like tight crew where we were just family. And I had the option to apply to magnet programs elsewhere. And I just could not fathom the idea of separating from my friends. We were just, I don't know, it was like the one constant in my life. And so I just was like, I'll just be the art kid perpetually forever.
when I moved to Miami, I was 12 years old and I was always jealous. Like I was really jealous of the Gizmo girls that were like, cause I was like, you guys have known each other forever. And I had just moved around so long. So I totally, you know, that esa cultura of just like having your crew. But then I also remember that like people would go off on their, like some guys would become refs. Do you remember the term ref?
You talked about this in the first episode with me.
Yeah, you don't remember refs?
I do remember. We went into it. Okay, okay. But it's like, to me, in my world, it was like kind of a derogatory term.
Yeah, yeah. It is. But it was like people that liked booty music.
No,
like
that's not what it was in my...
least in Kendall, it was different then.
No.
So did you all grunge out at the same time?
Oh,
or
yeah.
Did some people split off?
I think the split off happened a little later once we became like adults. No, past high school.
Oh, okay.
We stayed tight through all of middle school. Actually, we met in elementary school. We kind of solidified the crew in middle school. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. We met in elementary school, solidified the crew in middle school. And it was clear like this was, we were going to always hang out with each other. And then in high school, we stayed tight. We stayed very tight. And then I was the first to get an apartment.
Mm-hmm.
And so they would come party at my house all the time. And, or like, you know, you start, when people pass away, you start pulling out photos, things that help you kind of connect to those times. And it's like, they were all in all of the events, all the birthdays, all the fucking ragers I had. And we stayed as tight as we could. And then once I moved away, we kind of started to disperse, but Juan Diego always kept me at arm's length. Like he always kept me like close by. He didn't let me stray too far. Cause after that I became a bit of a runner. I was always like running off and kind of like disappearing, going to new cities and meeting new people, going to art school and like, you know, finding new groups to hang out with. But Juan Diego like always kept me close and he just didn't let me stray too far. He always let me know he was thinking about me and he wanted to know what was going on and like genuinely engaged and interested.
What was he into? What were his like?
Nature.
He was, oh, really?
Yeah. He was kind of wild. He was always wild. He always had a wildness about him. He couldn't sit still. He was like a kind of hyper wiry kid, but he was very charming. He could talk to anyone. But he, I think ultimately felt best in nature.
Like Miami nature to me is a lot of beaches, not the same as LA nature, which is like hiking out
in
mountains.
Yeah. And so I think in being in South Florida for him was being in the water. And that was how he got access, but I don't think it was enough. Mm-hmm. And so he had family in Colorado that he would visit, you know, every once in a while. And I think ultimately after I left and moved out west, he then also moved to Colorado and started living in a small ski town. And I think that's where he felt most comfortable and most free.
Mm.
And he really got to like tap in and explore because he was a Boy Scout.
Yeah.
And so I think he was always trying to like figure out how to level up his relationship to nature.
He was actually a Boy Scout?
Yeah.
Okay.
He was actually a Boy Scout. I think he was always
not
a Boy
Scout. Not a metaphor.
No. And then he became a firefighter.
He
was like fighting fires, like a volunteer firefighter. And he was like really savvy. He was not a academic person, but incredibly smart and savvy and could fix anything, could build anything. And like, just, I don't know. He had a wisdom about him that was just like otherworldly. And he was always encouraging us to like take risks and do the scary thing. But I think he felt best out in the mountains.
Yeah. Well, how do you feel like you've changed? I'll give you my example.
Because, since this?
Since this.
Oh, my God.
Do you want me to lead?
Go ahead.
So I have been going through a midlife crisis in a very, very big way in terms, like, my situation is a little bit different. My dad died. He was 76, I think. And I, you know, we come from that old ass Cuban stock that lives to like the 90s.
Yeah.
You know, my grandfather died at 101 on my mom's side and on my dad's
side. So he died young.
Yeah.
You know, like for
in comparison.
Yeah.
And I have not been taking care of myself at all, assuming that I had those genes, you know, and then when my dad died, he died of a heart attack. It was pretty sudden and or just surprising. Like when my mom called me, I was like, I could tell from her tone, something bad had happened. And I thought she was going to tell me my grandmother died, who's like almost 100 at this point. Wow. And you know, she's got like the full on dementia. So it's like, it's almost like it's crazy to feel like it doesn't matter to go say hi to somebody because they just are not going to remember it, you know? And then it just makes you sad. And my mom has to do that on a regular basis because it's her mom, you know, she's got to take care of her. But yeah, in between those two places of just like, you die suddenly or you die of really old age and you don't no longer have control over anything and you're just like a passive thing. It's gotten me thinking really hard about what it is that I want to do with the rest of my life. And we talked before about how frustrating some of the things about this show have been recently coming back. But honestly, like this is what I like to do, you know, like just sit down and have a conversation about people with people. It really is an intimate thing that we're doing with the headphones. It's so different than just having a conversation sitting across the table, even, you know, like we're whispering into each other's ears, you know, but
also there's an element of the awareness that this is being recorded.
This
is going to be an archive. But to me, it's like all of that is kind of exciting. It's just a different way to have a conversation and revisit it. Like I was grateful that I could revisit our first conversation.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that happens to me doing the show as a side note is that I go back and I edit the episodes, but a lot of people that are on the show never go back and listen to the episodes because they're so nervous about it. So I have this like reliving of like an intimate moment that we have. And I'm like, oh, we're cool. And then they're like all stressed out about the show and like, oh, they're all self-conscious about it. And I get it, but it is one of those things where, because I have to keep working on the show, I can't just like never listen to it again. What was I saying? Just
How this has affected you, grief, midlife crisis, taking care of yourself.
I've wanted a sports car. I'm not getting one, but I've wanted one really, really bad because I'm realizing. And then I told my uncle got himself a Porsche and I was all excited for him. And then I found out it was SUV and I was like, ugh. And then my mom, like, because he was like, I always wanted a Porsche. And then he responded, like, you better get that sports car while you can still get down into it.
Yeah, that's true. And get out of it.
Yeah. But it really has made me present in how little time I have left. Does that make sense? Like,
yeah.
I'm counting 30 years, you know, from I'm 43. So
I think also, maybe I'm sure like your dad, having it be your father and, you know, thinking about like the inheritance of the genes or like the sort of the health maybe has you thinking about that. But I mean, what are you doing to help you kind of process that stuff? Well, and that's what I'm learning is that I'm really lucky. I feel so grateful that I have something to pour myself into.
Which is what? Art?
My art practice. Uh-huh. And also like, because I have this performance background, it's helping me pull from that so that I can talk about these experiences in a way that is accessing, it's creating access for other people to open up about their experiences with mental health, with suicidal tendencies, with feeling like they're trapped in vulnerabilities that they can't communicate about. So do you have to check on something?
Yeah, let me just make sure I didn't move the camera too much.
So I'm glad I have something to pour myself into, and I'm realizing, God, I don't know, I would explode if I didn't.
Did you do any therapy?
Oh, I do therapy all the time.
Okay.
Consistently, for years.
I took a break from it. I haven't been in therapy since like COVID, but I'm trying to sign up back up for it. It is really hard to do it on your own. You know what I mean? Like to process some of this stuff and like, you just reminded me because you said like, what are you doing to process? I think I did also start painting a lot when it first happened. Like it was like really the only thing that I had the will to do.
Yeah.
What about Dabda?
Huh?
Do you know Dabda? Denial, anger, dab, bargaining.
Acceptance. Yeah. Bargaining. I didn't do so much bargaining and, I didn't really have the denial. I mean, it's not denial. It was just like, it was really hard. Like, it's still hard to talk about him in a past tense.
Mm-hmm.
I think having a support group, as in the friends, we all just jumped in right away and like, we're very present with each other. We immediately dropped our lives and flew out there. We packed up his apartment. We showed up. And so we confronted the hardest parts of this together. So I wasn't alone. None of us were alone in it. We're still not.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it was just instinctual, but I think that helped us. I mean, individually, it helped me not be in denial. Mm-hmm. I couldn't be in denial. It's like the silence is deafening on his end. You know what I mean? I don't know. It's like, I think this is what I was surprised by is that this kind of grief, like it feels different every minute.
Mm-hmm.
It brings up so much. It's nonlinear. It's very confusing. It's overwhelming. One day you're fine, and then the next day you're not. And you just kind of have to sit with it. And the further you deny it, the more you suffer about it.
Yeah.
Really. You have to accept that this is going to be painful no matter what, and in ways that you can't control.
Yeah. What I first did was realize that no one would hold it against me if I drank too much.
Oh. Yeah, I did a lot of that.
And for the first time I had, I when I stopped drinking, I was like feeling like withdrawals of like, you know,
yeah.
It was like, I've never had that before in my life. And like, I was like, okay, there was a moment where I was like, okay, let's put a cap on it. And then I did it. And I was like, holy shit. Like I have really harmed myself. Yeah. This, yeah. You know,
I had to take a break too. It's like, I think maybe that's the denial aspect where you're just trying to numb it out. But also the world expects you to get up and go to work and expects you to just not talk about it. Cause it happened. You went to the memorial, you're done.
Yeah.
And we're kind of done hearing about it. We're done watching you be sad. And it doesn't fucking work that way. It just doesn't. Yeah. Like, let me be a fucking hot mess for as long as I need to be. This person was incredibly important to me.
No.
Fuck off.
Yeah.
But I had to go to work and I had to teach and be in front of students and hear them talk about their suicidal tendencies. And I was like, everywhere I went, I was reminded of what was going on and I could not perform through it. And I was like, why do I have to?
How did Juan Diego pass?
He killed himself.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that.
He took his own life and there was nothing to, like so many questions unanswered. He's someone who suffered from mental health issues since we were kids, didn't have language around it. We knew we had language for it with each other. We knew he was having episodes. That's what we called it. And so we knew to like keep tabs on him more, to be around him, to communicate with him in certain ways. And like we had a language within us to, as family, for him to help him get through. We knew that they were cycles, you know? And they were a little different each time, but it's like, now I get to look back on this and be like, oh, fuck. We tried to like sustain him, and his best friend, who's like his brother, I think was a huge support in his life.
Mm-hmm.
Kept him together for a really long time. But I think he self-prescribed being in nature and in sort of in the mountains and in isolation. And I think that worked only to a certain point.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, I mean, I sometimes say he had an episode he couldn't get out of.
Yeah.
And that, I think this is also why I feel responsibility to get better at talking about this, because I feel like that is preventable.
Mm-hmm.
And in our culture, we're not allowed to have mental health issues, to not feel okay in the head, to...
In the Cuban culture or American culture or both?
Kind of both, but certainly in Latin culture. And I think that's very tied to masculinity, you know, where it's like, yo no soy loca.
Yeah.
There's a big gap between I'm not crazy and I'm having a panic attack. Why? Because all of this is going on, because there's a lot of pressure in my life. I don't know that. I just feel like we grew up with a real lack of language around it. And I think things are starting to come around. Even I hear it in my students. They have language around being aware with what they struggle with, but it's like, we didn't grow up with that. And I think, you know, that was very much perpetuated in a way that I see the results of that in my friend. And I'm like, he could have gotten help. I don't know. Maybe not, but I feel like that can be avoidable, and finding more language to talk about.
Did he ever get any like medication or any help like that?
He did. And I think it was the wrong thing for him. It made him feel like a zombie. Yeah. They prescribed him lithium, you know? Anyway, the point is that I think he just never got the right kind of support. And I also think he never really figured out or never got the resources to understand the language around when he needed help and what kind of help. And I think a lot of people suffer from this sort of thing, and they suffer in silence. Mm-hmm. And I think once it gets to a certain point, then it becomes a really sort of point of no return.
Yeah.
And I think COVID, he lost his mother, his dog, and then he found himself alone there. And I think there was like this flurry of things that he just struggled to get out of. And here we are.
Yeah.
So that happened, and it's fucking awful and tragic, and I'm just still learning to communicate about it. But I came home, and like my reflex is to lean on what I know how to do. And part of me was like, I want to honor him. I also need to carve out space where I can just be a fucking mess about it. So my garage became my like my world to just like be a hot mess, drink all the wine I needed, and like play with my tools, because he was someone I met in, like, we became really tight friends in art class, my first art class. And I was a cranky, curmudgeon-y, like unapproachable teenager. I was not cute. I was underdeveloped. I have no clue why he insisted on talking to me and being my friend, but he did. And he would come by.
Porque eres tremenda.
Yeah, I don't know. I was tremenda. So I was a pain in the ass and just bitter. And my cousin had died at the beginning of middle school. Uh-huh. So I went into adolescence with a sort of experience of mortality that
I didn't have at that time. Yeah.
Yeah. And so my cousin was 28 when he died, and it was very sudden. And that was hard. And I was 12, 11. And I was like, great.
Yeah.
Cool. Life is awesome. Can't wait to grow up. And I think he noticed a sort of angstiness in me, and he wanted to kind of come by and be my friend and validate me. And we became friends, and then he started walking me home every day for 3 years.
Wow.
And this like beautiful platonic friendship.
Middle schoolers walking home is crazy.
Through the golf course every day.
Now, that's like a 90s ass.
I know. How beautiful is that? Like, and I still have this visual of us like, almost like if I was a drone, like above us walking through with like my, you know, with my like baggy
sticking
pants.
To your shirt.
With my
it's
braces.
Miami.
Oh, and my flannel, because I insisted on wearing a flannel. And
it was grunge.
He also like spent a lot of time alone too, because we had single moms who worked a lot, had other preoccupations outside of being mothers. So we really like kind of filled in a sort of loneliness gap, you know, that I think it ended up solidifying this like really awesome bond that, it's like, I always loved him. He was honestly one of my favorite people, always. The funniest person in the world. The best roaster. But now it's like in his absence, I had to like look back. And also being with my other friends, it's like we were reminding each other of things that happened. And it's like, he walked me home every day for 3 years. I don't think he understood the impact that had on me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I didn't realize that he had killed himself. People that have listened to the show know that like a while back, I think 2020, my friend Julie shot herself, and that was pretty crazy. That is a different kind of grief.
It is, and that's
there's a helplessness involved in there that's different than when my dad. That there's helplessness involved with my dad too. But it is very, very difficult. And I'm going to try not to make you cry, but,
good luck. It's really hard not to.
Yeah.
I made a whole gallery of people cry yesterday. I didn't mean to, but it was like all these like young undergrads like bawling, and I was like, I'm sorry, this is not, actually I'm not sorry, I don't want to be sorry, but this is honestly what happens.
No, it's very, very, very,
you know,
tough.
And
what I always think about, her name was Julie, and what I always think about that is just how much pain she was in.
Yeah, because you and know, that's, like, that's what I think about too.
That is crazy. I've always had mental health issues as well, where I've like contemplated self harm and stuff like that. But the idea of
getting to that point
of just losing all hope is so, so hard. And then the other thing that's interesting about it that I've recently kind of started to contemplate is that there is an element of suicide that is homicidal, right? Like where you are killing off the world, right? You're not just, you're cutting off everything, which is really, really, really sad, you know, because that means that there is no comfort there at all.
I know. And I just like the idea of the loneliness he experienced to get to that point is what.
No, it's overwhelming. Yeah, I'm so sorry.
I'm sorry for you too, but that's the thing. It's like I start talking about it and then someone says, I had an, like yesterday I was approached by all these kids that had a story.
Yeah, yeah.
And that were willing to say it out loud in front of everyone else, whether it was about themselves or about someone they cared about. This is a larger topic that is way more relatable than we want to admit. Mm-hmm. And we all will confront death no matter what. And so this, it's weird to be like, I'm trying to see the bright side of it. It's not about that. It's just like, how can this be generative? And I think as an artist, I always feel a responsibility to use what I do to help create conversations that can be generative, even around something like this. And so that's kind of just what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to like be honest about the fact that I'm still trying to figure this out. I'm trying to figure out how to support my friends when they have hard days, because we still have them and we're going to keep having them because this person was really important to us.
Yeah.
And everyone's got a relationship to someone who, you know, they're going to deal with this at some point. And so how can we be more ready for it? I feel like we really avoid talking about these things.
Yeah.
And it's very much part of our mortality. So why not? It's the only way that we can really approach this better and have a healthier relationship to this is to learn and talk about it.
It sounds like he was still his lovable self though, in terms of like, did you like what my experience with Julie was that first of all, you don't know what to do with yourself, right? Like you really don't know what to do with yourself. You have all these feelings and they're not going away and they just flood. But you know, then you get into the question of what could I have done? And the reality is that there's no, like, that's not a productive way of thinking about it. Yeah. Ultimately, I mean, not to tell you not to think about that way, but ultimately there, the end of the end final conclusion is that, you know,
this was
just happening, you know, and it's awful. That's a really hard thing to accept.
And it's like this cycle. It's like you go into the, when the grief really flares, I'm realizing it flares. Right. Mm-hmm. And so when it flares, I mean, when I came back, it never stopped.
No.
It did not fucking stop. I couldn't sleep. It was going on so hard. I couldn't do a lot of things, but it flares now. And so there's some days I wake up and I'm like, oh, and there's that. There's this, like, you spiral into the thinking of like, what could I have done? How could I have persisted harder to make him feel supported? Where did I fail in communicating with him or make him feel like he's not alone? Should I have done this? Could I have flown out there?
And also
he said this to me, I should have paid attention to that because that was a code.
Yeah.
I should have known. And we all do this. Like we all talk about this. And so luckily we're supporting each other.
Yeah.
It's not, none of us are alone.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm so grateful to my dudes for them to feel okay with being vulnerable with me and with each other about it, because I don't think we would have talked like this before. Yeah. I don't think any of us would have.
Are they mostly Cubans?
No.
Okay.
Nicoyas.
Son Latino?
Because, oh, yeah.
Because Latinos are pretty decent. They don't talk about mental health that much, but credit to us, we do talk about feelings a lot more.
We do talk about feelings, but I think think before we reverted to being together, and it was always this like roasting laugh. It was a lot of laughter. And like ragging on each other and laughing and like partying, but like having a good time. And but a lot of it was like this dude banter, you know, where it was like, bro, shut the fuck up, brah, brah, brah. And like just like ragging on each other and everyone laughing. It was almost like performative. Like, you know,
love through talking shit.
And he was like the master of that, you know, he was so fucking witty and smart. It was, you peed yourself at least once every time you hung out with him. But it's become a little more dynamic than that. And so, you know, now maybe some days someone wakes up and had a bad dream and they share it. Or today I was reminded of him because I saw this bird and blah, blah, blah. And I remember this story and I'm feeling really sad today, like really tender, soft, vulnerable, like aspects to my friends that I didn't see. Like, I know it's in everyone, but these are not sides to these dudes that I ever got to see in the past. And so now, and Juan Diego was very soft with me.
Oh, really?
We were,
He wouldn't roast you as hard.
He never roasted me.
He would pull punches.
No, he like treated me like I was important to him with love. He would like, he was very affectionate, cariñoso with me. He called me cubanita, linda. He loved, he would always tell me, Cristina, I love you so much. I love you so much. He would tell me all the fucking time. And then I always think, did I say it enough back?
No.
And even till the last week, he was texting me, asking me to call him. He wanted to talk to me about something. I'll never know what.
No.
So he, we had a very particular relationship where I think he felt, a tenderness and a warmth with me that I'm really lucky I got to have.
Yeah. It's tough, man. It's tough. I, the, that's especially like the losing the mom and the dog. I don't know. I'm like one of the things that I'm trying to process and I'm trying to prepare. Like I'm spending a lot more time talking to my little sister and having establishing more of a direct relationship with her because I know it's going to be hard when my mom's gone, you know, and I don't know how I'm going to deal with that. Cause I had no, like, you know, I love my dad, but I wasn't very close to him. Like I always kind of kept him. He was somebody that like in our relationship, he understood that there was something about the way he did things sometimes that were very unsettling for me and would throw me, like, I'm a very sensitive person, being an artist and whatnot. And I, it's really easy to throw me off when it's somebody like my dad, it's somebody that whose approval I care about and things like that. And so he always kind of understood.
Parents also know how to poke you in the right place to get a response out of you.
But credit to him. He knew when to give me space. Like he, it, you know, and we would go through large stretches of when, by the way, his ashes are right behind me. So he's in the room, with us. But, he, and that's a mind fuck, but he was a very traumatized person. He grew up in a very, you know, he's Cuban of the exile. Very, if you know anything about the time, the Batista times, there were also bombs.
Yeah.
There was, it was always you couldn't talk about the government back then either. It's not like communism brought in this like sudden change
of oppression. No, that's been going on before.
So, and then, and there was a lot of stuff, like he would tell me stories and I would tell him like, dude, you have got to stop telling me this story because it is freaking me out. Like things of like abuse that he remembered fondly, you know, and stuff like that, where he just didn't understand what was being done to him. And, but yeah, I mean, one of the things, so like, what happened with Julie was that she was staying in an apartment and it got black mold.
Oh.
And she went into a coma for a year.
Oh my God.
And then after she came out of the coma, she just wasn't right.
Yeah.
She just couldn't catch up, you know? And it, that is like, that's one of those things of like, you know, how can you comfort someone who's lost their mom and make them feel like it's okay? You're not the mom, you know? And like, and to some degree, like it really makes me sad. I think Julie, her depression lasted longer, and it manifested in a way that made her alienate people a little bit, you know, which yeah. happens a lot with suicide and with depression. Like, it's what I said on her when I memorialized her on the show was that it's like part of that disease makes you isolate yourself.
Yeah.
You know, it's like,
he did that too. Juanita yeah. did it too.
And it's one of those things where you're like, well, this person doesn't want to talk to me, or they're too much to handle, or things like that. And then it happens and you're like, fuck, man, mm-hmm. I did not read this situation right. And you start to feel the guilt.
You never want to think that that's how things are going to end up.
No,
you
definitely know,
like
not.
Ever.
Yeah.
You want to think, oh, they're having a bad patch. Or
they've
you
been
know,
through this before.
Yeah. Or like they're busy and you know. Yeah.
But the frustrating thing with Julie is that she refused to get help. You know, she always thought that she was a little smarter than the therapist.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. And I think that that's the disease. I think the disease, like the depression being the disease that I'm talking about, mm-hmm. Especially of that level, it is self justifying, mm-hmm. you know? And it's myopic and it's self, reinforcing where you're like, oh, well, this person, you know, like I remember we have a mutual friend. I'm not going to say his name because I don't want to, like, you know, put her personal stuff on blast. But I remember her being like, I know that I'm not that close with this person, but I know that he cares enough about me. And in fact, he was the one that told me that she had shot herself. Mm. Do you remember Tamiami gun shop?
Yeah.
Her dad owned it.
Oh,
so
God.
She was working there and had...
And this other subtopic of guns yeah, within this too, but yeah.
Yeah, in Florida, especially, like, I'm not anti-gun, but I never owned a gun because I know where that's going to end up, you know, in my mouth, you know? Hmm. I mean, not so much anymore. I honestly, and for anybody that struggles with this, like, I have been medicated for so long, I can't even relate anymore to that level of depression, which is why... The idea of being that depressed that you just finally decide it's over, you can't take it anymore. Like,
yeah.
That is such a foreign concept to me, even though yeah. I have been through major depressions through my whole life and all of that.
And I think it's important to say that out loud too. It's like, I mean, I had students yesterday say I've felt suicidal out loud to like a gallery. And I'm like, you know, this is a lot more common of a thought than we want to admit. I think a lot of people can get to that point of despair and toy with the idea, but also get out of it and get support to not ever be in that headspace again.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
My favorite Norm Macdonald joke, then I showed it to my mom when I was in Miami, is he's like, I think it was Anthony Bourdain that he was talking about. And he's like, and every time someone kills themselves, people are like, I don't know why he did it. And he goes, you don't? You don't know about life?
Yeah.
How it's an never-ending, like, yeah. Source of disappointment? Like, life is a very hard thing, and mm-hmm. and it doesn't seem to be getting easier. I listened to my boomers talk about the heyday. Like,
no, you we guys got used it to, rough. Yeah,
you guys
I know.
Got used to fuck in the streets.
Yeah. Chill out. You used to fuck without condoms. This is amazing.
Yeah, but yeah, it is a thing. It is a crazy thing. And I do think that there is such a huge gap between being depressed. Like, I think that, like, I think the typical thing that happens is that when somebody tells, like, let's say you tell a therapist that you're suicidal, they take that shit very seriously.
Yeah.
They'll put you on suicide watch and all of that. And it is that serious. Mm-hmm. But I think that so many people have thoughts like that, that it becomes less important, or you just feel like, oh, everybody does that. And I think that, like, you know, like when I have been my most depressed, I always felt like everybody agreed with my worldview. They were just pretending, you know, like that's how dark depression can get on you. It lies to you. It's a yeah. perceptual issue. You start to think that,
absolutely.
Know, like everybody's just pretending like they're happy, but everybody really knows deep down inside the core of like, and if you, you know, like if I remember I had a friend that was going through something similar and I gave her this workbook that my therapist had, And she was just shocked at how much the workbook knew exactly what her thoughts were, you know, like how dark her thoughts were. And at that point I wasn't in there myself, but it really is like these formulaic thought patterns that just kind of keep going and
feed off each other and snowball.
Yeah. And it's really hard. It's like when you're tripping and you're having a bad trip. And like, you can't convince yourself that you're not having a bad trip.
Yeah.
It is like that. It is very, you know, I think that is one of the things that I'm grateful for about, having had our, I would say it was fun, but it was also kind of traumatic because we lost a lot of people along the way being drug kids.
Oh yeah.
But yeah, that really, the experiences with psychedelics and the experiences with those drugs, you know, I remember there was a period where I was like, no, I'm going to think my way out of this. And I have like serious OCD. Yeah, that is cultural. Yeah,
because it's like, no, sacúdete. You got to just like keep moving forward. Like, you don't have time to be weak.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that's also a patriarchal thing. You know what I mean? So,
Capitalist patriarchal.
Yeah, but also with machismo, it's like that kind of upholds that too. Time to be soft and weak.
I would also say that wasps are like that too. In terms of like not talking about
their
feelings.
All I can do is talk about my own experience.
I know, but I just don't want us to end up shitting on Cubans.
I mean, we do that anyway, but
yeah, I know, but we can shit on other things.
It's not just Cubans. It's like, I think it's just, I mean, any sort of, I think, yeah.
I think people just don't want, I think the majority of people, and that's one of the nice things about the art community, is that there are a lot of people that are open about their things like that, you know? And I think also, like, I think the reason that I like queer people, like the people that used to do drugs and want, like, and all of that, is that they're creative people that just didn't have, like, didn't necessarily conform to a certain subset of like cultural rules, especially in the 90s, you know, like, like, now it's not as punk to be gay, but in the 90s, that shit was punk, dog. That shit was anti-establishment as fuck.
I think especially in growing up in Miami, it was like, that was making a statement in the sense that, you know, you had to be ready to sort of fight about it at any cost.
But also anywhere. Miami Miami is one of the gayest places I've ever been.
It is, but it was also like one of the, I felt like
there was a negotiation between the kids and the parents going on when we were young, I would say.
Yeah, but also like say in the high school dynamics, it was like, they really had to take care of each other because it was like, they had to be ready to defend themselves for this. And it's like, obviously no different than now, but I think there is a whole lot more acceptance for like the versatility of identities now, even pronouns and talking about all those things. Like, none of that existed when we were in high school.
And not to minimize the death of that next person, you know, that it still happens. I'm not saying that it's not a courageous thing to be queer. I'm just saying that like when I was younger, I identified with that level of like when I was younger, I saw that and I was like, that's fucking like sticking
it's
it to
brave
the,
as fuck.
It's brave, you know?
Yeah. To be yourself and out.
Yeah. Whereas now there's a lot more cultural acceptance for it. And, you know, even there's a whole political party that is like pro gay marriage, which it wasn't up until 2008, you know, or it wasn't as recently as 2008.
We didn't have as much representation.
No,
you know, in media at all.
So, but also the drug kids. And I think that there is like a creativity in those three subsets, you know, like the drug kids were maybe, I think that like
also a space for vulnerability. It's like you could just kind of like belt out these things. And there wasn't going to be this rejection or like typically of like being able to talk through those things or make work about it or write about it.
But yeah, I mean, this is really, really heavy stuff.
It is, but it's life.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it is. It is.
And
I feel like mine is a lot more expected, you know, like your dad dies.
Yeah.
Your best friend does not necessarily kill themselves. So I have a lot of sympathy. I was deeply in love with Julie on many levels, as a person and all of that. And she was very interesting, very contrarian, very fun, and very successful. She was a chemist. She left the chemistry and then she started doing, she started like reselling clothes and was making crazy amounts of money. Mm. Like it was never a success thing with her.
Yeah.
You know, she was not like a loser in those terms. So it was always, it's interesting when like somebody, you know, like it's like going back to Anthony Bourdain. It's like,
yeah,
like that guy, there's the Dave Chappelle joke about like that motherfucker killed himself. And then like the guy that works at that works at Foot Locker hasn't,
yeah.
You know, like it's not tied to success or anything else. It's just like a really interesting chemical thing that, I mean, not interesting, it's really sad thing that happens. And like, and honestly, well, I feel like I dodged the bullet.
I think there's an internal world to everyone that doesn't always find a way out. I don't know. I think in the end, like this whole like reflecting on this, and again, I'm still learning from it because it's like,
how many months ago was that?
September.
Oh wow, that is pretty still.
Yeah.
Pretty fresh.
And going through the holidays was just tough. Yeah. But I think I'm still learning from it, and I don't know what could have been different, but I just think isolation and loneliness are what's like really perpetuates all this. And mm-hmm. like, if there's anything we can do to resolve that, that's where I feel if people can, like, I can't say, call this hotline number or talk to this kind of therapist or like, you know, get this kind of support. Like that feels really clinical and formulaic. And it's like, I think in the end, it's like, talk to someone you trust, find someone that you trust that you can get weird with and be like your super raw self. And like, isolate yourself, because I think that once it gets to that point there, that's where things can get dark and in a sort of unrevocable way.
Well, what's interesting about Juan Diego is that it sounds like he did have a big community that loved him, which I feel like also Julie had, which she didn't realize. There are other people that like for example, when I was depressed, I didn't really have a huge social circle of people. I remember it was so obvious, and I was hanging out with this group of people, and one day they were as a group all just saying like, if anybody here is suicidal, you know, like they were like clearly opening the floor up for me to come open to them, but I didn't know them that well.
Yeah.
And it was, they were like reaching out and trying to make it known that like, it's okay. And that we care about you. And, you know, I think the thing that is really hard sometimes, some people don't have like people that care about them or that they can reach out to, or they do, and then they reach out and the person doesn't realize how serious the situation is. So I would say,
is that a helicopter?
This is LA.
Wow, but you feel it.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's really bad.
Wow.
Yeah, that is a helicopter. We're pretty close to downtown.
Okay.
But yeah, I would definitely end it with a plea to go get help. You know, and if you have a drug problem, you know, most therapists are going to reject you. So unfortunately your only angle is to go to like AA, and that's where your best bet. Yeah. But if you don't have a drug problem, get therapy.
I think a good way to end is just like going back to the whole, like, I don't take care of myself. And it's like really evaluating what that means, and how that can be sustainable for you.
Yeah.
Like, and maybe you can't do it alone. No, I think in the end, it's like, we can't do anything alone.
You can't think your way out of depression.
You can't self-prescribe. You can't isolate yourself.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's different every time. Like, you could have been depressed one way when you were in your 20s and different when you're in your 40s. You're in a different life state. There's different factors. I think post-COVID, we're still processing affected you. And I say that as an educator. I hear it in my students all the time. That had a huge impact on their life, on top of just life happening, you know, getting older and health. And I think it all really boils down to like really asking yourself, how can you like self-love and really take care of yourself, and really dark, like deep evaluation of how that can be changed. And being honest with like what you need. I don't have a larger sort of anecdote. I'm still very much in understanding this all and trying to process it in the best way I know how, which is through my art practice. And trying to learn language around it, you know, and be present for my friends and the people that are closest to me, and asking them to support me when I need it.
Yeah.
And that's, I don't know, it's just been a very humbling experience to deal with this. And it's like, he's teaching me. Mm-hmm. This is a crazy thing. It's like, somehow I'm still grateful to him for still teaching me something.
Yeah.
Like, how fucking insane is that? But I'm going to love him forever. And he's still very much present in my life and in his own ways, but just love on each other fucking hard, man. I don't know.
Yeah. And it, and I think the, you know, like, I have a friend that I just saw recently. I'm not going to say names, but he's, as long as I've known him, I love him. I love him to death. As long as I've known him, he's just been drinking himself to death. And in really weird ways, it shows up. Like, this is like, he told me that he wanted to get life insurance that would pay out. And I was like, you don't have any kids. Who is that for? And he goes, for my mom. And And to some degree, there's not much I can do there too. You know, he has to do it himself. All I can do is tell him that that is fucking crazy. That is a crazy way to think about the world, that you are expecting to die before your mother. And like, and it's this, it's a, he's Catholic. So it's a very Catholic approach to like, to processing your guilt and to absolving yourself. But like,
I have to say, and like, I know that you've dealt with your friend, passing away also through suicide, but if I had an ability to like change anything, it's like, I would be more relentless about supporting him. I wouldn't even think twice. I wouldn't go, huh, that was weird. I'd like drop everything. Like, you know, if I could have the time back, I still have dreams where I'm trying to get to him to prevent it.
Yeah.
You know, so
it's so sad.
I would be as relentless as possible to just not block the possibility of anything like this happening, because it's just, I those are the things that I carry with me that I'm always going to feel regretful for. And we all talk about these situations where it's like, I could have done this, I could have done that. And it's selfish, but it's just, I really feel like we have to show up for each other, like, so hard.
Yeah, yeah. No, definitely. No, it's a hard thing. And you never know, like, what is so tragic about it is that all he needed, all we feel like we needed to do is get them through that one moment.
No.
You know, and then once you get past that one moment, you feel like it would have been fine. But that's how dark that moment was. It stopped everything. And it stopped the world.
I think, it stops the world. And I think, you know, we're selfish. So we want to think that we can control that.
Yeah.
And
I think part of your healing process is going to be realizing that you can't, you know.
And it may take me a really long time to get there. Yeah. But again, this is not, there's no real clear way to do this, but
it's brutal.
Trying to figure it out, and others are doing it too. And
so are we like family now at this point? Because we've shared some pretty heavy stuff.
We're art family.
Yeah, we're art family for sure. No,
this is how I operate too, though.
No, I know.
So me this too. Is like, if you can hang with me through this kind of like talking and experience, it's like, this is just a new topic, but I'm like this kind of about everything. I think our first conversation, I was a little safe about it. Now listening back on it.
We talked mad shit then.
We did, but I think I was a little conservative about it, just because I was like, we'll see how this goes. And I don't know this person, and it's COVID, and this is the first time I talked to someone outside of like,
I was like,
my partner. Una you were like, croqueta, pastelito.
Yeah.
But I...
Cubas y Castro no.
Always. Patria vida.
La patria.
But I don't want to be as restricted about talking about these sort of things. Like,
no, life is short. I really appreciate that.
Life is fragile. Like, I'm really, and it's also how I weed out who I can hang with. Mm. If people can't hang with me being like raw and kind of like unapologetically how I am, then we probably don't need to be having a conversation. So I appreciate this. Like, well, I love
I'm
it.
Trying to not feel exploitative right now.
You know, and I thought about that too with talking about my friend's, you know, death. I'm like, are people thinking that I'm trying to exploit his passing? You know, but these are things. It's like when you throw yourself to be really vulnerable, you're like, you have all these doubts and imposter syndrome things that pop up. Yeah. But you kind of have to set that shit aside and just move forward. If you need to like go there, you go there.
Yeah.
And you are craving these conversations too, because I think it's generative for you too. So
no, I mean, I love having conversations, period. The more intimate, the better, you know. I just, usually I start with talking to people about like their background, but I only talk to you about your background so that we can reminisce.
Yeah.
Even though, like, that is
there's
a weird
common thing. Ground there.
But it's such a weird thing to be able to reminisce with someone you didn't grow up with.
Yeah.
You know?
But we can, like, kind of be on the same page about so many things.
I know how you feel about people that went to Gulliver.
I have no feelings about Gulliver. The private schools, Columbus and all that, I'm like, oh, God.
But, we were contemporaries of what's his name? What's the kid, Gloria Stefan's kid? And he was always in the news for his drug problems and shit like that. And I was like, that's us.
Poor guy. He just had a spotlight on him. Know, he couldn't do anything without people being up his ass.
Yeah, exactly. You know, pero yeah. Anyway, well, we can wrap up and just talk some more shit off air.
I just hope like people can appreciate the opportunity to like kind of just throw down about whatever subject, you know, you just offer a space to like.
Oh, you don't need to defend me against the people I was telling you about.
I know, I don't
earlier.
Need to do anything, but I'm serious. It's like, to me, it's like, this is really great. I love Thank this you. Opportunity. So like, I just hope you don't get discouraged by people who don't know how to appreciate it or like enjoy it.
Yeah,
like get fucking over yourself. Just like find a way to talk to another human. And if it gets weird, it gets weird. But
No.
I love it.
I think that's why we've clicked. Like, I feel, honestly, we have maybe spoken via text and via interviews. We've had two interviews and we've like gone back and forth via text very briefly.
Yeah.
You know,
but
like,
there's a familiarity that's there.
Yeah. And there's like, there is something, there is a cultural thing there where I kind of know, like, I know how you feel about a lot of things that are deeply embedded in the Cuban psyche of like, you know, and I know
you could assume that you may be wrong.
No, but I've seen you talk about like, you know, I've seen you talk about Cuban politics while everybody's like, oh, all we got to do is end the embargo. I'm like,
nope.
You know, and then
that
like,
really changed my relationship to social media.
Yeah. Yeah.
That whole
fiasco.
Yeah. I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah, no, it's
I'm way more particular about where I have those conversations and where I advocate for what.
Yeah,
because of that dynamic. A lot of people think they know what they're talking about when it comes to Cuban politics. And it's like,
I realize how much of an anti-gesture social media politics is.
Yeah.
Like it's
very
really
performative
is.
Allyship. Like I.
Yeah, yeah. Nobody's doing. I mean, I know that I'm not doing shit. You know, like, honestly.
Well, I know, but I think just because it happens on Instagram doesn't mean that you're not having conversations, that you're not, like, I'm an educator. Mm-hmm. That's more generative to me to invest my, like, perspective and influence than to, like, publicly display on social media. I feel like I know what I'm doing. I know how I feel about things, but I think there's this, like, pressure to perform on social media that I am no longer interested in engaging in about certain things because it just I'm being self-protective but I know what I believe in, you know.
No,
what I mean?
But I think that's a healthy thing. I don't know, I have very mixed feelings about all of this, especially with the George Floyd protests and all of it. It doesn't seem to break out of itself.
No,
you know, it still seems to be a way of saying that I understand something. And I really think that people,
I'm cool.
I'm with the next thing.
And I've been like pulled into it and
I comment on the situation in Gaza. I just, in terms of my own self-reflection about it, I'm like, how much am I really doing? Not much. I'm just making myself feel better by saying something that I don't necessarily think, you know, is necessary. I honestly think there's no stopping this. I really, unfortunately, I really don't. I think that the reality that we do not
this is
live
not
in
a new issue. This is not a new like phenomenon. It's very far out of reach. And I think for a lot of people, this just arrived at their scope of vision.
Yeah.
What people don't know is half of my family is Israeli Jewish. The other half, like my dad is Syrian, so Cuban, but we have Syrian background. My cousin's husband is Syrian. So like we have a relationship to the Middle East that is like, we're very aware of the complicated history that there is there and what's been going on. This is not new.
Is Jubin an offensive term?
No. Okay. I don't think so. I call my brothers Jubin all the time. I hope they're not offended by that.
All right. Well, we hope we don't get kicked off of it.
No. Yeah. It's not. I don't think it's just Cuban Jewish. There are Cubans that are Jewish. In case anyone knew, it's a thing.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful thing.
Yeah. But Cubans also say, y los judíos.
Not my Cubans.
Not your Cubans.
Not my Cubans.
But at the Versailles, they do.
There's a lot of shit that goes on at the Versailles
that you don't condone, like Trump support.
Not interested. Yeah, it's like almost like we go just to kind of like see what the drama is, but there's a lot of anger at that little ventanita.
Yeah, las ventanitas. I miss those though when I'm over here. Although I had a cholesterol diet reassessment, and that's not gonna work for me eating there.
Yeah,
I had a croqueta preparada, and I was like,
"Oh my god!" Last episode you talked about croqueta preparadas too.
We've eased up
on eating meat, and I'm like, "The fuck!" Sometimes I want, you know, so I'm like, "Vaca frito."
Yeah.
Anyway,
I appreciate these conversations. I really do. Anyway, well, thank you so much. I do think that suicide is something that is really, really hard to quantify. And in terms of like, you can have a psychological understanding of what it does to you to know that someone died, but to really have empathy for what that person was going through to decide.
Yeah.
You know.
And the wake of like just the impact it has that it leaves behind is really all I can really speak to is like this is very impactful, and it's for life. It's something that we're all carrying with for life. So I think just knowing, you know, if anyone's struggling with it, it's like this will be impactful to anyone you leave behind.
How do you think you're going to die?
I think about this sometimes. Mm-hmm. I want to have a healthy relationship to death. Part of me thinks I'm going to have a tragic accident.
Oh man, I hope not. Because I already like you, and I would have to grieve you.
But it can happen. I also like, this is weird, but fantasizing about like fucking lion, you know, maiming you and like out in the mountains, and you're having this amazing nature experience, and a lion just comes and just like fucks your life up. Or I don't know. I mean,
what do you think? Here's a more fun question. What do you think your last words are going to be? Viva la revolución!
Fuck off! Me cago en diez! I don't know. God.
We started to research lo dicho cubano, like my mom and I and,
like,
and
who's
my family.
We?
No, my whole family. We're like, me cago en Ceuta.
Me cago en diez. Me cago en la mierda.
Yeah.
Me cago en tu madre. Lots of shitting on shitting.
Come gofio.
I've never heard that one.
Come gofio. Oh, mm-hmm. Gofio is like something that they used to eat back in Cuba. It's like, but it's derogatory, so I guess. Yes, it's like maybe something poor people ate. I don't know. Erejun come gofio is like you're a fucking idiot.
Or erejun bofe.
Bofe, I don't know.
Ay, que bofe. It's like saying que ordinario.
Yeah, that's my grandma.
Que bofe.
My grandmother's go-to.
I remember you saying that.
My fucking aristocratic grandmother who's got dementia.
No seas ordinario.
Ay, que ordinario. Me hablas así. All right, let's wrap it up.
I don't think we're capable of wrapping
it up. All right.
No, for real. We're going to stop talking.
Thank you. Thank you so much for coming by.
Thank you for having me.
You're here by way of South Carolina, by the way. You're not an LA person. We have scheduled this since the holidays.
I know. We scheduled this way before and then had to adjust because of this, actually.
Yeah.
But yeah, this has been a long time coming. And so has the show that brought me here. It's just funny that all these things were kind of in the works before all this happened. And then it's interesting to talk about this as part of like what frames me coming back to California, which honestly, it's like California just always receives me and loves me in a way that I'm like, always like, God damn it.
Yeah. We don't have to talk shit about it right now, but I have my issues with California.
I know.
Especially like after spending some time in Miami, I was like, oh my God, there's not, like, you know what the difference in home, like it's 13 for 100,000 in Florida and 460 for 100,000 here.
It's very palpable, and it seems worse than before I left.
I just don't know what my taxes are going to.
And that's, what is happening? Like, why aren't people getting resources? Like, where's that money going? Like, clearly we know exactly where it could go, and it's just not happening, and it's just getting worse. So, that's the, you know, it's like, I love being here, and then I turn around and I'm like, why is this still happening?
Well, the for such a crazy liberal place, like Miami doesn't care enough about property values. They're zoning against like Airbnb and it's dropping property values. I don't know why we can't just give people's houses here and let the property values drop just a little bit, but who knows? Anyway, let's wrap this up.
Are you sure?
Yeah. Thank you so much. And
thank you.
We'll be back next week with another guest and another topic that may or may not be art related.